We have 1-3. So we are in Perek Ches, or Ches, chapter 8. It is page 967 if you are using the stone Tanakh. We started chapter 8 last time. Remember that this is part of the message that Yeshaya brings to King Ahaz, king of Judea, of Yehuda. First we had Sha'ar Yashuv, right? The son Sha'ar Yashuv, the one who's already born. And the message there is the remnant will return, meaning even if Judea goes into exile, they will ultimately come back. You just have to do what is good and what is right, which is, in this context, don't join an alliance with the Northern Kingdom, don't make an alliance with the Assyrians. That was followed by the second son, Immanuel, and the message is that God is with us once again, and we talked a lot about Immanuel, and who is this supposed to be, and who is it not supposed to be. And then we had the beginning of Perek Chet, the beginning of chapter 8, the third son, Maher Shalal Hashbaz, right? Which means that someone is going to raid and take spoils really quickly, really soon. And this was a message which he was told not to speak, but instead to write. He should take this great big piece of whatever it is, we don't know, parchment presumably, but he doesn't say, and write in a way that everybody can see it, that the northern kingdom is going to be conquered soon. That's the message of these words, Maher Shalal Chash Baz. We even said that he isn't necessarily writing words. He might be making pictures. That was an explanation. That was the approach of Malbim. He's supposed to draw pictures of a raiding army, right? One didn't know. I didn't know that was a criteria for a prophet, that you have to be a good artist. Maybe you don't have to be a good artist, and maybe they didn't understand him. I don't know. But that's, according to Malbim, he's actually drawing pictures. Okay. And he invoked Uriah and Zechariah. We talked about them at the end last time. But that brings us to chapter 8, sentences 5 to 10, where we're going to go back to the name Immanuel and invoke it as part of a message to the Jews to go slow and to trust in God. Chapter 8, sentence 5. Vayosef Hashem daber elai od lemor, God continued to say to me, this is a new message that God is giving to Yeshaya, after the Maher Shalal Hashbaz message, Yan ki ma'as ha'am hazeh ismea shiloach ha'ochim la'ach. This nation has rejected the waters of the Shiloach, which flows slowly. Where is the Shiloach? Where is it physically? Like where? Right, it's a water resource for Yerushalayim is the key. This is a source of water for Yerushalayim, and the Jews are rejecting the Shiloach, which flows slowly, umisos es ritzinu ben Ramaliyahu, and instead what they want is to rejoice with Ritzin, king of Aram, and Pekach ben Ramaliyahu, king of Yisrael. In other words, this is a message that targets the Jews who want to make alliances, the camp within Yerushalayim, and therefore Judea, that wants to make the alliances. You don't want to be patient, like the Shiloach. You're looking to rush ahead and join the Syro-Ephraimite alliance. Vilachin, therefore, Hine Hashem, chapter 8, sentence 7. Hine Hashem ma'ale aleihem es mei hanahar ha'atsumim v'harabim. I have bad news for you. You didn't like the slow-flowing stream, and you wanted the faster-flowing brook, or whatever this is. I'm bringing a great big river, right? Its name is Assyria. Melach Ashur ves Kol Kvodo, the king of Assyria in all his glory. Ve'alah kol afikav v'halach kol gedosav, and he's going to overflow his channels and his boundaries and flood everything. V'chalach b'Yehuda shatam ve'avar, he's going to flood Judea ad savar yagia. He will reach all the way up to the neck, which is good. It means they'll still be able to breathe. But it means, you know, you're in danger. V'haya, and suddenly a switch of metaphors. Mutos knafav melo rochav artzecha Immanuel. His wingspan is going to fill the breadth of your land, Immanuel. Immanuel is the name for Judea, the name for the child, and therefore the name for Judea, that God is with us. Paul, you look perplexed.
Yes, I am. in Dystonia on what page?
Page 967.
Stone.
Stone Tanakh.
967.
Yeah.
967 in
really?
Stone is Hashayahu.
That's because that's what we're doing.
You know what? I just came from a Brusa.
You're learning so much Torah that the Sarim get over.
I just came from a Shir, not Shir, a Habrusa on Yirmiyahu.
Oh, okay.
Your Miyah is in here.
Okay. If you want to have a nice word on the parsha, we can mix it all together. Okay.
Wow.
So, that happens to me with frightening regularity. So the central image here, granted this wingspan thing at the end, is an image of water. And this is classic Yeshaya. Right? You have poetry, you have an image, and he brings down the hammer using the image. Right? The stream and the river, and it's so nice, and yeah, the Assyrians are going to come and just drown everybody. It's a very Yeshaya prophecy. So, in terms of why he chooses the Silwan, right, Mei Shiloach, for the symbol of Judea and of whoever it is that they don't want to be with, is found in the Malbim in source number one. He notes, you can see it in Tanakh, but the Malbim mentions it here, HaShiloach Nahar Gichon. This is the river known as Gichon, Mashchu Etzlo et Shlomo. When that's where they coronated Shlomo, it's where you coronated kings. And therefore, it means this is the house of David. That's who they have rejected. The nation wants to drop them, as the Gemara in Sanhedrin says in source number 2. Chalafta katz ama hadeba malchusa de beis David. The nation has rejected the reign of the house of David. Oh, sorry, just English. Which led them gently, like the gently flowing Shiloach, and they chose Ritzin and Ben Ramalia, or Bar Ramalia in the Aramaic of the Gemara. That's the simple read of what's going on. However, worth noting, there's an additional level of prophecy here that Rashi quotes, bless you. Rashi quotes this from the Gemara here, which sees it differently. And the idea is, and I brought you a piece of the Gemara here, but not the most salient part of it, I think. And that is, the next generation down for this whole thing, after Ahaz is done, right? Ahaz has a son. His name is? Oh, come on. It was the first sentence in the book. Chizkiyahu. Right? Chizkiyahu is the next king after Ahaz. And Chizkiyahu is going to have to deal with an Assyrian invasion as well. And he's also going to have a camp that's going to say, let's make alliances and let's surrender. And that's going to be led by a man by the name of Shevna, who's going to earn special condemnation within Yeshaya. Shevna is going to be remarkable. We're not going to get there for a while, though. The other approach in the Gemara in source number 3 is that what's going on here, this reference to how they want to drop the slow-flowing stream in favor of the faster-flowing river, is actually about how they want to drop Chizkiyahu in favor of Shevna. And what I brought you from that Gemara is where they invoke Chizkiyahu and how the Jews wanted to reject the Judeans in favor of other allies. So they point out here that Pekach ben Remalio, the king of Israel at this point, eats 40 sa'ah of pigeons for dessert. They released the Canadian Food Guide. I saw that a news report about that. I'm not sure where this fits in. No pigeons. Well, 40 sa'ah of pigeons is a lot of pigeons. For reference, 40 sa'ah is the shear, minimum shear for a kosher mikvah. It's supposed to be an amma by an amma, a cubit by a cubit, by 3 cubits. In other words, about the height of what's supposed to be the height that could include a standard human form. That's how much he's eating for dessert. Wow. Whereas Chizkiyahu, his whole meal was a liter of greens. I don't know if their leader was the same as our leader, but it's not the point. The point is that that the house of David is much more humble, and the people are resentful of this. They don't want that. They want their leaders to be big and flashy and wealthy. So Hashem says, I am going to bring a flood upon them, and the flood, of course, is the Assyrian invasion. And that brings us, going back into the text, sentences 9 and 10, where Hashem addresses the Assyrians directly. Yeshaya addresses the Assyrians. Ro'u amim v'chotu. You should come in and crush the whoever is there, and then chotu, as they take it here, be destroyed. V'ha'azinu kol merchakei aretz. Now hear this, all who are far away. Hisazru v'chotu, hisazru v'chotu. Gird yourselves and then be crushed. Gird yourselves and then be crushed. This wave of those who are going to strategize and come against Yerushalayim, and the classic pasuk, Utsu Eitza Vitufar Dabru Davar Velo Yakum Ki Imanu Kale. There's that name again. You can plot all you like, and it will be destroyed. You can speak all you like. It's not going to endure anyway. It's not going to help you. This, according to Rashi and Radak, is targeting the Assyrians and saying to the Assyrians, we want you to come in. We want you to come attack Yisrael. You're going to attack Yehuda, and you aren't going to succeed. That's the idea. Clear?
So this is prophesying that Asher is going to attack Yehuda and will not
succeed against.
Is there any possibility when you think of wings, you don't think of a negative, you think of wings kind of protecting. Is there any possibility that the wings of God will protect?
So I can only tell you that that's not the way the commentators seem to take it. That's all I can say. I didn't see everybody on every pasuk, and so it's possible that someone does. It's just not what I've seen.
A different metaphor.
Yeah, but keep in mind that in the context, it's speaking about a destroyer. And it hasn't changed. We don't have a new reference point for the pronoun. You know, mutos kenafav, his wings, the his is referring, it seems, to the antecedent of the Assyrians. Doesn't sound like it, though. So Hashem continues with... Sorry, any other thoughts or questions on that section? Hashem continues with a powerful message to Yeshaya, and he says it's a powerful message. Sentence 11. Kicho amar Hashem elai bechezkas hayad. So said God to me with the strength of a hand, or with a mighty hand, depending on how you read the words. V'yisereini milechez bederech ha'am hazeh. He rebuked me not to follow the path of this nation. Lemor, saying the following. And this is another classic pasuk. Lo somrun kasher l'chol asher yomar ha'am hazeh kasher. When people say there is a conspiracy, meaning when people plan, when people conspire, that doesn't mean that you have to go along with it. Just because the group says it's a good idea to do X, doesn't mean you have to go along with it. Vesmo ra'o lo siru v'lo saritsu. Don't be afraid of this nation who are telling you to make the alliances. As Hashem tzvakos oso takdishu, you shall sanctify God. V'humo ra'achem v'humo aritzchem. You want to know who you should be afraid of? Not the nation. In sentence 12, he said, don't be afraid of the nation. Instead, be afraid of God. That's what you should be obeying. The Hayala Mikdash, and he, God, will be for a sanctuary, Ula Evan Negev, Ula Tsur Mechshol, as well as a source of stumbling, Lishnei Batei Yisrael, for the two houses of Israel, meaning Yehuda and Yisrael. Lepa, and that's, Janine, that's an example where Yisrael is now used collectively for everybody, not just about the northern kingdom. Lefach ulamokesh liyoshev Yerushalayim. It will be a source of stumbling for the dwellers of Jerusalem. V'chashlu bam rabim. Many are going to stumble on it. V'naflu v'nishbaru. They will fall and be broken. V'nokshu v'nilkadu. They will be trapped. They will be caught. So before we continue from this, I wanted to show you a important Gemara in Sanhedrin in source number 4. This again goes forward in time to the generation of Chizkiyahu and Shevna. So Chizkiyahu is the king of Judea who is being told by Yeshaya, stand firm, And Shevna is the leader in Yerushalayim who is telling everybody, no, we should in fact ally ourselves with the Assyrians. Ki asa Sancheir v'tzar Allah di Yerushalayim, v'tzar Allah di Yerushalayim, I should say. When Sancheir laid siege to Jerusalem, Shevna wrote a note and shot it via an arrow into the Assyrian camp, saying, Shevna and his supporters wish to make peace, Chizkiah and his supporters will not make peace. And he quotes a pasuk in Tehillim, the wicked have arranged their bow, they have set their arrow on the bowstring. So this is the bow, it's the betrayal of Chizkiyahu. Chizkiyah was afraid, saying, perhaps, God forbid, God follows the majority. And since the majority wishes to surrender, so must we. Right? We have a principle in the Torah, you follow the majority. The prophet Yeshaya came and told him the message that we see here. And again, this is anachronistic. The message is given a generation earlier to Ahaz, but the Gemara doesn't really mind that. And you can recognize that. Yeah, meaning, when a prophet says something, I wonder about this in general. Does that mean the prophet said it once? Or that this became the prophet's message, which the prophet might have given to multiple audiences over time? Right? A politician campaigns for office and has a stump speech. It's his platform. It's what he wants to market. And he's going to tell anybody who will listen what his platform is, and he's going to repeat the words over and over and over again to as many audiences as he can get. So it wouldn't surprise me to think that where Yeshaya had a message that was relevant in one generation, and he felt it was relevant again for Chizkiyahu, that's fine, I'll say it again. He's got it memorized. So take a look at what happens here. The prophet Yeshaya came and told him, do not say Kesher. And again, it means here a majority. Whenever this nation says Kesher, meaning it is a Kesher of the wicked, and the Kesher of the wicked does not count. Meaning this democratic vote is not legitimate. This idea is actually quoted in halachic works regarding the issue of democratic government, meaning there's a lot of discussion in halachic authorities in the 20th century about whether a democratic election has authority in Jewish law, or whether we're really supposed to wait for a theocratic monarchy of some kind that's going to govern us. Well, let me tell you, democracy's working real well there. That's got it all over the kings. So the answer from many halachic authorities, Rav Herzog wrote extensively about this, is to say no, democracy has ample basis in Tanakh and certainly in halacha in general. And at the same time, just because the majority votes on something, that doesn't mean we have to follow it. Sometimes the majority is simply wrong, and they draw on this pasuk as the basis for it. Just because there's a kasher doesn't mean you have to go along with it. That's the idea. So, sentences 16 to 18 are very hard to read. Sorry, 16 to 18 is what is... What did I write it in my notes as? What did I do? Oh, never mind. I see what I did. Yes. 16 to 18 are hard to read. That's confirmed. It's page 969. Sor te'udah v'chasom Torah. So they read it here as fasten this warning and seal the teaching, belimudai, among my students. Abarbanel says the word tsor doesn't mean to fasten. The word tsor is like nitsor, which means to guard. Exactly. Sorry? To keep, to guard. So the way that Abarbanel reads it is, guard the Torah that I am teaching you, teach it to future generations, so that you won't end up like Yisrael. We don't want you to end up like Yisrael, so... Reading the sentences here, guard the Teudah, guard this Torah, and teach it. V'chikisi l'Hashem hamastir panam mibeis Yaakov. And I, Yeshaya says, I will wait for God, who hides his face from the house of Yaakov. V'kivisi lo, I will hope for him. Hine anochi, v'hayiladim asher nasan li Hashem, le'osozu l'mofsim b'Yisrael. The I and the children Hashem gave me as signs in Israel, right? The ones with the names. Me'im Hashem Tzvakos Hashochein Bahar Tzion. We are the signs from God, or the children of the signs from God who dwells on Har Tzion. So Abarbanel says what he's saying is, keep on teaching this Torah, so that everybody will remember it. The however, whereas we read 16 to 18, the Gemara has a different read, found in various Midrashim as well as in the Gemara in Sanhedrin, which I brought you on the sheet, and it says that actually tzor is to tie up, which we find quite a bit in the Torah, and that this is what Achaz did. Tzor Teuda was Achaz's command to seal up, as you see here, the Torah. Or as some have it, to seal the Avodah, to seal the service. But the but here it's in this Gemara number 5, it's to seal the teaching of the Torah, to seal the service in the Beis HaMikdash as well. The so the first version of it is it's God saying teach the Torah. Your second version of it, the Gemara's version of it, is that it's actually Achaz saying don't teach these things anymore. And then you have Ibn Ezra, who goes his own route. And Ibn Ezra in source number 6 first mentions what I quoted to you from Abarbanel, that some say it's missing a nun, it's nitzor. But he says the correct read is that it's like, and you shall bind the silver, v'tzarta kesef, which is a sentence, a passage in the Torah, to bind something, like the form of chatom, the grammatical form of chatom. It means seal these prophecies, the Torah and Teudah, meaning store them away for the future. So Abarbanel says, it's teach this lesson to everybody. The Gemara says, it's Achaz saying, I don't want you teaching any of this. And Ibn Ezra says, taking the Gemara's read of it being bound up, but he says it's God saying, this message isn't for this generation. You're going to have to hold on to this idea. It will be relevant for the future. Which fits, because then he goes on to say, I wait for God, meaning I'm waiting for God to tell me when it's time for me to teach the message. And then you get sentences 19 and 20, which wrap up this segment. V'chi yomru aleichem, when they say to you, you means those who are loyal. They, those who are not loyal. So when those who are not loyal to God say to you, Dirshu el ha'ovos ve'el ha'yid'onim, ha'metzaf tzafim v'hamahagim. Go seek the ovot and yid'onim. Right, what is an ov? Yeah.
Some
type of necromancy specifically. Right? If you remember the Ov who Shaul consulted, right, to speak to Shmuel, an Ov is somebody who tries to summon the spirits of the dead for conversation. Yidoni, similar idea, mentioned together in the Torah, uses animal bones to perform some kind of incantation. Rambam famously thinks that it's all a joke and that the reason you're not allowed to do this is because it's foolishness and it's prohibited in the Torah to be foolish. The others disagreed and said, no, there's actually a thing. Like you could, if you know what you're doing, you could succeed, and God is saying, I don't want you to do it. However you read it, it's about communication with the dead, and that's going to be really important for these sentences. When those who do not want to follow the prophecies of God say, go talk to the Ovot and Yidonim, Hametzach Tzefim v'hamahagim. Those are great words. Mlitzach Tzef, as they put it here, is to chirp. Well translated. Mahagim, who snort. He's making fun of them.
Tzef, do they use that for birds?
Yes, precisely. The Hallo Am El Elokav Yidrosh. The nation talks to its God. That's where we seek advice. Be'ad HaChayim El HaMeitim. Are we going to go? We're going to go to the dead to seek advice for the living. What in the world do you mean? Take a look at Ibn Ezra. I brought him for you in number 6. In number 7, he says, "Zos HaTshuva." This is the response. This nation will seek its God. It's mockery, like Eliyahu, right? Eliyahu on Mount Carmel, where the prophets of the Baal are having trouble reaching the Baal. The Baal is out right now. So how could we seek the statues which are dead on behalf of the living? Meaning, why should I look at an Avodah Zarah? Why should I look at an idol on behalf of those who are living? But Malbim and others say no. It's the Ov and Yidoni are all about seeking the words of the dead. So it's literally, why would I go look for counsel from those who have passed away? Let me talk to the living God. That's the idea. So when they say, let's look to the idols, I say, I'm going to talk to God. And the and so he writes, L'Torah v'L'Teuda, and he swears by the Torah, Im lo yomru kadavar hazeh, asher ein lo shachar. The he says the this is what they're going to say. The expression im lo is the expression of the oath. If they're not going to say the these words, asher ein lo shachar, which should not be entertained. That's the idea. So what he has done in this section is to say, don't go to these alliances, don't trust them. Yes, there are a lot of people who want to do it. That doesn't matter. Your trust should be in God, and don't turn to the gods of others. Which, by the way, remember when we introduced Ahaz a couple of weeks ago, we said that Ahaz tries to build altars modeled on the altars of other nations. So it's Ahaz himself who tries to do that. And this is a rebuke, really, for him. Even though his altars have not yet been built, but this message is going to end up being a rebuke of him. We don't abandon our God in order to seek out the gods of others. So right now what we have is a negative message. Don't do this and don't do that. That's what we have. He has to still predict. So what is going to happen? That's what's going to be in the last three psukim of the parak. Ralph.
Is there a reason why this passage is straight talk and the previous one is all symbolism, all poetry?
Yeah, interesting. I mean, this one also has poetry to it. The image of the chirping birds, right, for the idols that they ignore. The multiple invocations of Torah and Te'udah would be another one. I think you're right, it's a different style. You don't have the imagery that you saw in the previous one where the water image carried through so nicely.
Is it a different audience, or is what he's saying doesn't lend itself to a poetic?
I think it may be simply that you can't be all poetry all the time. Like, people can't listen to that. You need to break it up. That's what I would think.
Yeah, straight talk.
Yeah. But he's not done. I mean, I happen to find the poetry more forceful than the straight talk. You know, the image of the water is just such a great image. That's going to stay with me a lot longer than you know, don't turn to the idols. It's such a dramatic image, which is what it's there for. But in sentences 21 to 23, he tells you, he predicts that somebody is going to collapse. And here, again, you have a little bit of confusion as to whom he is talking about. I would have assumed he's talking about Yisrael. The northern kingdom is going to collapse. That's what it sounds like to me. And Rashi, Mitzudat, David, and Malbim are good company to be in. Because that's what they all think is being predicted here. Take a look at this, and we'll read it through with that perspective, but then we'll see that Ibn Ezra has a couple of other ideas. Sentences 21 to 23. Prediction. Va'avar ba nikshevera'ev. Somebody who is hard up, somebody who is hungry, is going to pass through this land in the future. V'hayach yir'av, when he is hungry, v'hiskasaf, he is going to be angry. V'kileel b'malko uvelohav, he will curse his king, he will curse his god. Ufana l'mala, and then finally he will turn to God. So what this is meant to show is the north is going to be crushed by the Assyrians. And some Jew is going to be wandering through the northern kingdom where he had lived, that's now in ruins. And he's going to be starving. And at that point, he's going to curse the king who led them down this path. He's going to curse the idols that he worshipped. And he will turn his face to God. Turning upward, turning lamala, turning to the heavens, is an expression for turning to God. Ve'al eretz yabit, and he's going to look around at the land. V'hinei tsara v'chashecha me'uf tsuka v'afela menudach, which looks like Yeshaya just pulled out his dictionary and took out as many bad words as he possibly could to refer to the land. He's going to look at the land, and what's he going to see? Tsara. Trouble. They do misfortune. Okay. Chashecha, darkness. Mi'uf, from ayef, exhaustion. Sukkah, to be pressed. The va'afela, darkness again. Minudach, abandoned. So he's going to look around. The imagery again, Ralph, we're going back towards the poetry here. The imagery of the lonely wanderer in this desolate land who curses his king and he curses his idols and he looks up to God and then he looks at his land and it's all darkness and ruin. Kilo mu'af lasher mutzak la. You know who wasn't exhausted? The one who did this to the land. Ka'es harishon heikal arza zivulun ve'arza naftali. His first trip through, he ruined the land of Zvulun and Naphtali. Zvulun and Naphtali, if you think about where they are on the map, are northern Israel. That's where they are in the among the Shvatim. What happens is, Yerushalayim, you know, is between Yehuda in the south, and then Binyamin has the next tier of land, the east-west. So you have Binyamin, and then you have Dan next to them. And then north of that, you have Ephraim and Menashe. And then north of that, you have Yisachar and Zvulun. And then way up, you have Asher and Naphtali. That's the way it works. So Zvulun and Naphtali are the northernmost area in the land of Israel west of the Jordan. That's what we're saying. It's that northern area. And they are going to be the ones taken by the Assyrians first. The Ha'acharon Hichbid. And then, in his later trip through, they really became heavy. Derech Hayam, Ever HaYardain, Galila Goyim, to the Mediterranean, the shores of the Yardain, the Galil, the whole bit. So, the way that Rashi reads it, the way Mitzvot David reads it, the way Malbim reads it, is that this is a continuation of what's said before. That's why I brought you Rashi in source number 8, where he says, it's coming on the heels of what we said above. Don't walk in the path of this nation. Don't try to join that alliance in the north, because this is what it's going to look like. Yeah?
Why is it Galil, Hagoyim, Galilee of the nations? I mean,
right, so... Right, so remember that the word Goyim doesn't have to mean nations. First of all, we are also called Goy. But it can also mean tribes. So it will mean the tribes that inhabited that area. Frankly, either our tribes or Canaanite tribes, either way. But it can mean tribes. As a matter of fact, we're not there yet. But when we get to the line, the very famous line in Yeshaya, perhaps the most famous words in the entire book, in which he speaks about being Or LaGoyim, and we always render that as light unto the nations. One way to read it, we'll see, is it's light unto the Shvatim. It's a light to our own tribes. It's actually internal, not external. No one likes to read it that way, but that's one of the ways to read it. Except Goyim doesn't have to mean the nations as a whole. Gwila Goyim means the Galil, this land of the tribes towards the north. So that's one way to take this section. I think it's a reasonable way to take this section. But it's worth noting that even Ezra has these two other ways to read it that I'll just mention quickly. I brought a few in source number 9, but I'll explain it outside of the text. He says first that some contend that actually this is going to be in Yehuda, in Judea. And it's saying that those who did not listen to Yeshaya's instructions are going to suffer with the Assyrian invasion, because the Assyrians do conquer land in Yehuda, they just don't conquer Yerushalayim. So those who did not listen are going to end up being swept up in the Assyrian invasion, and then they will turn to God. And then Ibn Ezra himself has a third read, which is really a kind of strange read. He says actually the description is not about a Jew from Yisrael. And it's not about a Jew from Yehuda, it's about an Assyrian soldier. Meaning, armies are hard to feed. They need the land that they actually conquer to eat off of. And if the land is in ruins, then the army's out of luck. And what he's saying is, the land is going to be so desolate, this land conquered by the Assyrians, that an Assyrian soldier is going to wander through the land, and he's going to have nothing to eat. And he's going to curse his king who sent him out here on this mission and did not support him. He's going to curse his God. He's going to look up to the heavens. He's going to look around at the land and see it's all wasteland. It's the Assyrian who has done such a good job of destroying the land that now he's not going to have any food to eat. That's the third take on this by Ibn Ezra. Fascinating read. Yes, Janine.
I'm still confused about Yehuda and Israel. In Pasuk Yudalet, it talks about the Shnei Batei Israel.
Yes. No, but we said that was Yehuda and Israel.
Right. Yeah. And Mokesh Liyoshev, so it's not like both of them are going to be. Like, why would we say the damage is limited to Israel when in Yudalet he's predicting that both areas
are going to be. Right. Right, and the answer, I think, is because you had in between the instruction that could interrupt, starting in sentence 16, about either recording this and sealing it up for future generations, or it's Achaz saying that you shouldn't teach this, or it's guard what I'm telling you, and then the next part of it says we're not going to follow the idols, we're instead going to turn to God. So maybe at this point we're at a stage where we're saying Yehuda has listened, and it's just Israel that's going to be punished. Right. It's the problem, because you're operating with these three or four sentence units, and it's hard to keep track of whom he's addressing at any time, especially when the word Israel really can have more than one meaning. Makes it challenging. Paul.
I'm just curious about the message here. Is Ishayahu just saying, basically, all these enemies around them,
yes, that is precisely what he is saying. He's saying, you think that it makes sense politically to get yourself aligned with a stronger force? You are already aligned with a stronger force. You are aligned with God. And therefore, don't petition the Assyrians for help. Don't look to the Syro-Ephraimite alliance to be your saviors against the Assyrians. Stay neutral. Become Swiss. Didn't work in that region at that time, really. But that's the advice. So that's the big question, is can you apply this? You know, we noted, yes, it helps to have mountains around you. We noted when we first discussed this issue of alliances that there are cases in Tanakh where people enter into alliances and don't seem to be criticized for it. So it's not clear-cut. The answer really seems to be, go to your Navi and ask what the Navi wants you to do now, which is a problem when the Navi isn't answering his phone calls. Now what do I do? We don't have. That's where we get into trouble. But Yeshaya is giving specific instructions to Achaz, and what we're going to find out momentarily is what Achaz did with these instructions. Round file in the corner, but that's the idea here, is that he's telling him don't go along with these alliances, and the north is going to fall. And again, this last prediction could be the north and the south are going to fall. It depends on whose translation you work with, whose commentary you work with. The standard commentary here is that it's the north that we're talking about. Now, that is chapter 8. So what we get out of Parakhet, what we get out of chapter 8 is, again, we start out with the message, Maher Shalal Chashbaz, the Assyrians are coming soon and they're going to level everything. But you will survive in the event that you follow what God is telling you to do, Immanuel. Go slow and trust God, right? Don't go for the fast rushing water of the north or you will end up being flooded by the river of Assyria. The message to Yeshaya, and therefore to those who follow him, is don't go with the alliances, and the north is going to fall. Now, because these units are so hard to follow, we have a little bit of this, a little bit of this, that's going to change further into the book, but that's the way it is right now. So I thought I would be able to help a little bit with this by giving you a little bit of an outline of where things are going. So, if you take a look after number 11 on your sheet, I'm going to come back to number 11. But just a little bit of a sense of what's going on. In chapter 9, he's going to begin by predicting a Mashiach for Yehuda. That Mashiach may be Chizkiyahu, as we'll see. then it's going to continue to describe a four-stage collapse of Yisrael that will take us through all through chapter 9 into the beginning of chapter 10. Then it's going to bring us the Assyrian plan to invade Judea. The Assyrians have succeeded in the north, and now they want to invade Yehuda in the south. And then we're going to get a long description of God saving Judea. I'm going to weigh in to help you. And that's the very famous section that is read as the Haftorah on Pesach, Od Hayom Benov. That section, the one that speaks about the lion lying down with the lamb, or the wolf and the lamb, I always forget who's with whom. The lions and wolves and lambs and little children and snakes. But the bottom line is that everybody is safe. That messianic prediction, that's what's coming in that section where God describes what he's going to do for Yehuda to save them. And that's going to run us all the way through Perek Yud Bet. So in other words, chapter 9 is Mashiach for Yehuda, collapse for Yisrael, running into chapter 10. Chapter 10 is going to then address the Assyrian plan to invade Yehuda. That's after the outline that I put here on the sheet. They're going to talk about the plan to invade Yehuda, and then we get the rest of chapter 10 all the way through chapter 12, God saving Yehuda, and that's going to conclude this unit basically within Yeshaya, and then the entire focus is going to shift as instead Yeshaya speaks to the nations who surround us. But that's where things are going. Was that helpful at all? Okay, good. So what does Ahaz do with this remarkable advice that Yeshaya is giving to him? So on your sheet in source number 11, I gave you what Ahaz does, because the book of Yeshaya isn't going to tell us. We're not going to get played out, and Ahaz said back to Yeshayahu. So look at Kings 2, chapter 16. It is on 921, thank you. 921. Chapter 16, sentence 5. And we're just going to go through this very quickly, just because you have to know where things go and what happens. It's not fair to read all the instructions and then not find out what actually happened. So, looking through here, it's sentence 5 to sentence 20. Ritzin, king of Aram, Pekach, son of Remaliah, king of Yisrael, go to war against Yerushalayim. They lay siege to Ahaz. They can't win. At that point, what do? We've already read this. They do their end around. They go south, and they recapture the lands of Edom that Yehuda had taken, and they hand them back to Edom. We talked about that, Eilat and Eilot. Remember that? That was a while ago. And then Ahaz sends a message to the Assyrians. He picks his side, and his side is Ashur. So he sends a message to Tiglath-Pileser, king of Ashur, and he says, I am your son, I am your servant. The Avdecha Ubincha Ani. The idea of being his son obviously is not biological. It's a statement of subservience. And he says, what I want from you, Aleva Hushieni Mikaf Melech Aram, Mikaf Melech Yisrael, Akumim Olai. I want you to save me from the Syro-Ephraimite alliance. And what is he going to offer in return? Silver and gold found in the Beis HaMikdash, silver and gold found in the royal storehouses, and he sends them as a gift. The Hebrew is shochad, which we associate with a bribe, but it means a gift, to the Assyrian king. And the Assyrian king says, okay. And he goes to Damascus, and he conquers Aram. He was going there anyway, right? What's the difference? He's just a little richer now. And Ahaz goes to greet Tiglath-Pileser in Damascus. The fact that it's written Dumesek here, don't get hung up on, it's the same city. And he sees the altar in Damascus, the altar of the Assyrians. We talked about this. He sees the altar that the Assyrians have built. And he sends to Uriah HaKohen, who we talked about last week. He gives him instructions for how to build such an altar. And Uriah builds the altar as Ahaz has instructed him. That's what he does. And the king, Ahaz, comes back. We're in sentence 12. Comes back from Damascus. Sees the altar. Uses the altar. Brings his offerings and brings his libations and all of that. And the Mizbeach of God that's there as Well, he puts this other altar, this idolatrous one on the north side, we talked about this, the holiest side, of the altar in the house of God. And then in sentence 15, he commands Uriah the priest, saying, on the big Mizbeach, on the bigger altar, which I think is the altar that he has copied from the Assyrians, that's the one, I want you to bring karbanos in the morning and in the evening, and bring the king's special gifts as well as those of the nations, and the Mizbeach HaNechoshet, and the copper altar, Yalila Vaker. Yeah, I'll have that there also. And Uriah does exactly what Ahaz tells him to do, and then Ahaz does something further. He takes the stands that Shlomo had built that went under the kiyor, under the sinks that they had in the Mizbeach for washing their hands, and he separates them. And he separates several other items there, Mosach HaShabbat, Asher Banu, flip the page, and a whole bunch of other items, and he sends them to the Assyrian king. And that's the rest of Ahaz. That's it, and then he dies, and the next king is Chizkiyahu. That's the account. So Yeshaya did not succeed. Clear cut. If you jump to Divrei HaYamim Bet, Chronicles 2, chapter 28. That's my other reference for you on your sheet. Page 1995. You get a little more detail. We read some of this when we introduced Ahaz. We found out that he worships the Baal, and he worships in Ben Hinnom. He worships the Molech, right? And here you get a record of this military loss to the Northern Kingdom. How the Northern Kingdom kills 120,000 people in Yehuda in one day. Flipping the page, they also take people captive, they also take spoils, and there is an Avi, there's a prophet by the name of Oded, and Oded gives a message to the Northern Kingdom in the Shomron, and he says to them, you want to know why you beat the Southern Kingdom? It's because God is angry at them. And look at what you've done. You have murdered so many of them. So he says, you think you're going to take the Southern Kingdom as slaves? He says, you should know that's just going to increase your guilt before God. If this is what happened to them because they angered God, imagine what's going to happen to you. So what you should do is send the captives back. And at that point, they decided we don't want the captives, and they in fact released the captives. And then you get to Pasuk Tet Zayin, sentence 16, and you get again the story where Ahaz sends to the Assyrians for help. Now I have a much better understanding of why he sends the Assyrians for help. It wasn't only his fear of these different invaders, but they just lost 120,000 people. They had all these captives taken. And he doesn't look at the fact that a prophet came and had the captives released. He looks at the fact that he had no means of defending his people against anybody. And so he sends to Assyria, and he wants to make an alliance with them. He sends to Tiglath-Pileser, and he brings offerings to the gods, as they're described here. It's the gods of Damascus. There it sounds like he's sending to the gods of Damascus as opposed to the gods of the Assyrians. And then it continues on to the top of the next page, and you find his guilt in terms of making the alliance with the Assyrians as well as in worshipping idolatry. So that's where things go. You want to know where they go from here? That's where they go. Okay. Which brings us to the beginning of chapter 9. I don't know why I closed that. I shouldn't close that. Go back to Yeshaya. Yeshaya Perek Tet. So, the beginning of this chapter is beautiful and should be somewhat familiar It's page 969. The prediction of a Mashiach coming for Yehuda, for Judea. Everyone have it? Okay. Ha'am ha'olchim b'choshech ra'u or gadol. The nation that walked in darkness saw a great light. Yoshvei Beretz Tzalmaves, those who dwelled in the land of darkness, the shadow of death, or Naga Alehem. Light shined for them. Suddenly they came to light, right? We had all this darkness described in the previous chapter when he talked about the land being desolate and dark and abandoned and so on. The nation that had been in the dark is now going to come into the light. Herbisa Hagoy. Lo, higdaltas hasimcha. The word lo is written with an aleph, but we are taught to read it as though it has a vav, which is very different, obviously. Lo with a vav means to him. And the way to read this sentence then is, you increased the nation, for him you increased joy. Not, you did not increase joy, you did increase joy. Samchu lefanecha kisimchas bakatzir. He, the nation, they, rejoiced before you, God, like the joy of those who are in the harvest. Kasher yagilu b'chalkam shalal, like people who celebrate when they split up spoils. So in other words, he's now turning to address God and saying, you did such nice things for them. He's predicting, it hasn't happened yet. But you are going to do these nice things for them. Ki es ol subalo veis matei shechmo shevet hanoges bo hachitosa kiyom midyan. Because this yoke that they had as their burden, that which was on their shoulders, the rod that was striking them, you crushed like on the day of Midyan. The day of Midyan, the image is the day that God fought against Midyan with Gideon, back in the time of the Shoftim, when we were victorious over Midian. Yeshaya invokes something that happened centuries earlier. He says, that's what it's going to be like, because God has brought joy to us. And he continues to say, Ki kol se'on so'ein b'rash, v'simla megolala b'damim, v'aisal isreifa ma'acholes eish. You want to know what's in the north? In the north is terrible noise. The noise of being defeated in war. Clothing is going to be rolling in blood. And there will be a great fire, a consuming fire in the north as well. That's what's going to happen to the north. While for us, ki yeled yulad lanu, a son is born to us. Bein nitan lanu, a son is given to us. Vatihi hamisrael shichmo, the power of God in this case will be on his shoulders, instead of the yoke of the enemy. Vayikrash shemo, and he named him Pele Yoetz Kel Gibor Avi Ad Sar Shalom. We have to explain that, and whether that's really his name or something else. The wondrous counselor, the mighty God, the mighty powerful one. The Eternal Father, the Prince of Peace. Lemarbe hamisra ulshalom ein kates. The extension of and increase of the power, in this case it's the power of God. Ulshalom ein kates, peace without end. Al kisei David val mamlachto, on the throne of David and his empire, lahachino saul sada, to prepare it and support it, to establish it and support it, bimishpat ubitzdaka, with justice and with righteousness, right? Just like Yeshaya has been saying since the beginning of the book, right? Whenever each prophecy was said, the beginning of the book was Tzion b'mishpati padeh v'shaveh b'tzedaka, and he has not relented from that point of view. Mishpat u'tzedaka, justice and righteousness. Me'ata v'ad olam, from now and forever, kin'as Hashem tzvakos ta'aseh zos, God's outrage will do this, will bring this all about.
So
the
Christians,
yes,
to use this.
Yeah.
And obviously we don't interpret it that way, so how do we?
There's no reason to interpret it that way.
No,
I mean, we interpret it the way it says it. Meaning, the only thing they do here, this is not like the Alma passage. that we talked about, you know, last time, where the passage about the Alma, they look at the fact that it predicts a miracle and says, well, this is going to be the miracle, and that Alma is referring to this person and so on. Like, they have, you know, they have some extension of the sentence that they're trying to say. Here, all they do is say, oh, this is a prediction of a Messiah, a Prince of Peace. We think you're first ours. That's all they've done. It's just a co-opting of an existing verse. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense. And it doesn't make a whole lot of sense in particular because of the context. Who is this clearly speaking about? Can't be David. David happened already. David's long gone. This is someone who is described as being on the throne of David. Al-Kisei David v'al-Mamlachto. But it's not David. Sorry. This is Chizkiyahu. Your whole point in this section is to say Yisrael is going to be in ruins and there will be light for the southern kingdom. The light for the southern kingdom is going to come about via Chizkiyahu. It doesn't make any sense to say that it's talking about someone who isn't going to be around for another however many hundreds of years, 600 years, give or take. The whole idea of it doesn't make any sense. And that was Abarbanel's knock on them with the Alma. Also, you're giving a vision that's meant to reassure people about the Assyrian invasion. It doesn't make sense to say to them, don't worry about it, 600 years from now we've got your back. It doesn't work. As a matter of fact, if you go back to sentence 5, Ki yeled yulad lanu, we're going to see this shortly. Well, not shortly, we'll see this next week. But yeled yulad lanu means what? Yeah, a son has been born to us. Not a son will be.
Did you say yulad?
I said what it says here, yeah. Yeled yulad lanu. A son has been born to us. Yeah, no. No, yelet yulad lanu, a son has been born to us. The son who's been born to us already is Chizkiyahu, because Chizkiyahu was, as we said last time, I think 9 years old when Ahaz took power. 9 or 16, I forget. I think it was 9. He was 9 because Ahaz was king for 16 years, and then he's 25 when he becomes king. So it's describing Chizkiyahu. A son has already been born to us. You could do nolad, it would also work, yeah. Either one would be good. I mean, if I had to read it as future tense, I could say it's a poetic use of yulad, and therefore it means a son will have been born to us or something like that. If I had to read it about the future, I could torture it into doing so, and that's what they do. But the logic doesn't hold. It doesn't make any sense that this would be about something 600 years in the future when what you're talking about is God's promise, I'm going to save you from the Assyrian invasion. There aren't going to be any Assyrians in 600 years.
Couldn't it be referring to the Messiah that we believe is going to be coming? Because Messiah is not the solution.
Ah!
It's a temporary...
So good. Paul is feeding me my next line, but we are at a minute and a half left. So I want to at least start showing you the answer, because it's a very important point that Paul is making. So jump quickly into source number 12, and we're going to have to come back to it next time. The Gemara in Sanhedrin, commenting on that verse, L'mabei ha-misra u'l-shalom ein keitz, peace without end. Rabbi Tanchum said, Bakapara taught in Sipori, the word l'marbei, the first, that mem there, and the word marbei, is written like what you think of as a final mem. The way mem is usually written at the end of a word. It's sealed. So it asks, why is that? Mem is always open when it's in the middle of a word. Why is this one closed? God wanted to make Chizkiyahu into Mashiach, and Sanherib would have been the war of Gog and Magog, which is predicted in the prophet Yechezkel. Just as said before God, Master of the universe, David, King of Israel, sang many praises before you, and you did not make him Mashiach. You performed all these miracles for Chizkiyahu, and he did not sing before you, so you make him Mashiach. And so it was sealed. In other words, Chizkiyahu did not live up to expectations. What is this talking about? When did he not sing? What is this? Is what we have to talk about next time. But that's going to be a major theme for basically the rest of the book, is the idea that Chizkiyahu was supposed to be Mashiach. That was what was supposed to happen. So we'll pick up with that, God willing, next week.